Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Helmut. Coming up in the next hour, WFPL Stephanie Sanders continues her series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council.
And I don't have any problems at all getting support because I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm going to do something with a lot of thought to it and hoping I can sell it to somebody that has the same feelings that I do.
Also, Studio 619's Laura Shine talks with the up-and-coming folk group, The Green Cards.
We really weren't too concerned about a stylistic thing as far as needing to sound like anyone. We're pretty comfortable with who we sound like now. Mm-hmm. And we just went in to make the record we wanted to make.
And WFBL's Robin Fisher speaks with Morton Myers, author of the book Happy Accidents, Serendipity, and Modern Medical Breakthroughs.
But he didn't stop just then and pursued the other attributes of that inadvertently discovered chemical and came to realize that it yielded the key to him to understand the metabolism across the cell of the wall.
Now the news. Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Helmut. Coming up in a few minutes, Studio 619's Laura Shine talks with members of the folk group The Green Cards. First, we continue our series of interviews with members of Louisville's Metro Council. Over the last few weeks, WFPL Stephanie Sanders has talked with representatives from Districts 1 through 12. Today, we continue with Districts 13, 14, and 15. District 13 Councilwoman Vicki Welch is one of the newest members of the council. She was elected to the seat by the council when Ron Weston vacated his seat to become a member of the Kentucky General Assembly. WFPL Stephanie Sanders spoke with Welch about her transition into the council.
How was it when you first joined Metro Council, and how's your transition been?
It is a huge learning curve, of course. It's totally different than the medical field, although it's sort of the same because you're still taking care of people and their complaints and their issues, and even though it's not, well, some are medical issues. I mean, I've had a health fair now, and I try to connect people with your Passport Health Plan is where I work now, which is for low-income and disabled people. So I'm a contact for the people in my constituents in my area for that also. So it sort of goes hand in hand, and it's working out very well.
Do you feel that merger is working, continues to grow, is totally perfect? Now, what are your thoughts on merger?
Well, it's not perfect. This is will never be a perfect world, but I think merger has been a wonderful transition. People actually have a better voice in government. You know, before each out in the suburbs, which mine is all suburban area, before we had one commissioner who took care of 250,000 people. Now one council person takes care of 26,000. So you have a much closer contact, and it's much easier for each council person to take care of that area that they have than it was in the other situation. So it's a much better deal. Of course, it's going to take time to get all the kinks worked out, and things are running much more smoothly than they did 4 years ago when it first started. So I think that we're all learning, and we're just trying to do our best to keep our areas clean and nice for people to work and play.
Do you think that the council, when it comes down to major issues, such as the animal ordinance and smoking ban and things like that, do you think the council sometimes becomes too polarized or too partisan?
I guess it could be seen as that. But, you know, each council person has their own views for whatever their district and whatever their areas are. So, and some of them are their own beliefs, their own religious beliefs, their own health beliefs, or whatever the situation might be. So it really should not be a partisan issue on those issues. It should be how your district is made up and what you feel.
Have you found since you've been here that there are certain council members who are maybe more looked to for their experience or are more persuasive in pulling votes to their side of the argument and things like that?
Well, of course, for me, since I've only been here since March, I did go to those who were more experienced for their help on not really to know how to vote, but just how were things done in the past? What's the experience here? How are things supposed to go? That sort of thing, so that I could form a decision.
Stephanie Sanders also sat down with District 14 Councilman Bob Henderson to talk about whether the council's ever too polarized by political party.
I don't see D's and R's that much. People know me, knows that what's the best is what I'm going to go for. And we've got good people on both sides of this aisle. And I don't even take the chairs anymore or co-chairs because I work behind the scenes. I can go to the second floor where all the Republicans are and ask for help on an issue. And I don't have any problems at all getting support because I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm going to do something with a lot of thought to it and hoping I can sell it to somebody that has the same feelings that I do about what's best for our total community.
We spoke a little bit before we went on tape about your office doing some public education things in your district to kind of let people know what goes on here. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
We put out a newsletter. It goes to about 15,000 homes, and we put all kinds of information on what the ordinances are about parking in your yard, parking in the street, about your dogs. We put all that information in there as well. And one of the main things that I've done with, I've got 6 elementary schools, 1 middle school, 1 high school. Number one, I'm really death on keeping those schools clean because it's a perception of what people looks about in our community. But I've also partnered with every one of those schools from reading programs to walking tracks to the library. Everything I can probably, I'll get them to come up with half the money and I'll match it so they will take the lead. It's something they feel important enough to build a walking path, say, $30,000. You got to raise $15,000. That means the parents, teachers, everybody, kids all get involved to have something positive. And it helps the whole community because the community can use them as well as the schools. And so these are probably one of the most important things that we're really involved in is with the elementary and in the middle schools or in our schools in our district. Very, very important to me.
If you just met someone who had no idea what Metro Council was, what would be one thing you would want to convey to them about the council?
Well, there's a lot of cities, I don't know where you know it, a lot of cities and counties that's looking at us right now, about 35 of them, and I would like to let them know that we went from a very poor structure of government to merge and made, we can be all we can be. We've got 5 major projects, $1 billion UPS, $465 million museum, the arena, $500 million close to it, whatever. That shows you what can happen when communities go together, organize, and focus on something positive. I would say that we'll be a shining star already. We're glittering pretty good, but in our whole United States, I say this city right here is one that a lot of people's looking at, and the reason why is because of the structure, new structure of our government, and the council here working together. Overall, you know, a lot of times the news media wants to show where we're not working together. That's not the case. We work together and got a lot of respect, and it's about relationships up here. When you first come here, you're suspicious a lot of times of D's and R's, but we have got a relationship out right here now, second to none. I've got tremendous respect for everybody up here in this council.
And Stephanie also talks today with District 15 Councilwoman Mary Ann Butler, selected out of the May 2006 primary election. Butler is one of the newest council members.
Tell me about why you ran for this seat.
I have politics in my blood. I've grown up around politics and government, and I have 15 years with Commissioner Owen's office, and it is just a natural for me. I got a master's in public administration from U of L, and I'm one of those fortunate people that can use their degree and their job. So it's a natural for me. I love helping people, and this is a way to do it.
So how has you've been here a few weeks, 6 weeks or 7 weeks now, I think. Tell me how your transition has been, how your first month and a half or 2 months has gone.
I have been fortunate, because my years with Darrell Owens' office, to know how government operates. And I'm extremely fortunate to have a talented staff. Susan Hughes, my legislative assistant, has many years with IPL, knows many of the players. And Gary James is a retired sprinkler guy. And the two of them have worked well together, and Susan's knowledge has helped to move forward. Otherwise, we would be way behind. But we're moving forward. We were meeting with all the department directors and getting things going, and it's been fun so far.
Tell me your thoughts. And I realize that you haven't been in a legislative seat since then, but you don't live in a vacuum. So tell me your thoughts on merger and how it's working for Louisville.
I was not one of the, as you know, working for Darrell Owens, I was not one of the proponents of merger. I do think that many aspects of merger are good, but I would have liked to have seen when it was voted in that it would have waited a few years before it actually took place, so some of these departments could have been merged ahead of time. But it seems to be working right now. There's still a couple things that need to be tweaked, but it seems to be working for the most part.
As you were running for the seat, you were out meeting people in your district, things like that. Do you think that most people, either in your district or in Louisville, have an idea of what Metro Council is and what its function is?
I think most of them have a good idea what it is. Of course, there are people that, you know, don't pay attention to the news and what have you. But for the most part, I think they do. And from the number of calls we get at the office, a lot of people in the 15th district know how to find us. We've been helping a lot of them lately.
Okay, so for those people who do watch the news and maybe hear about Metro Council, maybe only when there's a large issue such as the animal ordinance or the smoking ban or things like that, do you think they're getting an accurate picture of what Metro Council is?
No, and the way I hope to change that is I'll do newsletters through the district. The first one should be going out this week, just bringing them up to speed on what we're doing. And hopefully, if you live in the 15th district and you want to know what's going on, send us your email address, and we'll put it on the list. And whenever we've got things going on, we'll send out emails. That's a cost-effective way to keep people up to date.
What if you think people are getting the wrong picture of what Metro Council is, what do you think the right picture is?
I think getting involved and going yourself to meetings or calling the elected official and talking to them. Sometimes the media or the group, it's not always the media, it may be a group that's lobbying for a certain piece of legislation is going to give their side of the legislation. So you need to educate yourself so you know both sides.
You can find the full versions of these interviews and previous interviews at our website, WFPL.org. From there, you can read more about the Metro Council and listen to an introductory feature about how the council works. When we come back, Studio 619's Laura Shine talks with The Green Cards, an up-and-coming folk music group. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up a little later in the show, WFPL's Robin Fisher talks with Dr. Morton Myers about medical breakthroughs that are discovered by accident. First, Studio 619's Laura Shine recently talked with the members of the Green Cards, Carol Young, Kim Warner, Eamon McLaughlin, and Matt Wingate. The new album is called Viridian.
We have enjoyed your music in the past, of course. You've had a couple of records, and now this new one is really gorgeous. It's called Viridian. I'm not quite sure what Viridian means. I probably could have looked it up. Anybody want to explain real quick?
Carol, well, this is your idea.
It's derived from the word viridis, which is Latin for green. Okay. But apparently Viridian is like the bluish-green tinge.
Huh.
So it's sort of, you know, it goes both ways. A bit of bluegrass here and the green cards. And so
right.
We were just looking for something a bit different on this record, other than a title of a song or something, you know.
Yeah.
And that just popped out.
Something that speaks green about the green cards. Now, the green cards, you know, makes people think of immigration and so forth. And most of you all are from Australia and England, right?
That's right.
Okay. And then you have a guitarist with you this time around, Matt Wingate. And where's Matt from?
He's from Huntsville, Alabama.
All right.
The token American in our band.
Right.
Yeah.
You've got to have one. Immigration every band's got to have one.
Immigration's a little iffy at the moment, so we thought we'd better bring one along with us. You know, keep us
light.
In the country.
Yeah, exactly. I like the story of how you guys got together, because being from not from the United States yet, you all met in the United States, correct?
Yeah, we met down in Austin, Texas, where mm-hmm. the band formed about a little over 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
And we just sort of ran into each other. Literally in the studio, actually.
That's wild.
And been playing music together ever since, driving around in a van ever since.
And I know you had a pretty big tour there for a while with Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan, correct?
We did, and we came here. I think we played the Slugger Stadium, didn't we? Yeah. Louisville Slugger Stadium.
That's right.
So, yeah, it was cool. We did. We did 7 weeks in the summer before last, 2005. We were out with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. It was quite a thrill. It was amazing for the band, and it was really fun. It really was.
And they did all minor baseball
yeah,
fields,
that's right. Yeah,
parks.
It was pretty incredible. You know, we came from little pub gigs in Austin, pretty much, to playing, you know, 10 to 15,000 people every night. It was amazing. Really
well, I imagine it's increased your fan base exponentially, I think.
It's been really good on a lot of it, in a lot of areas, and that's certainly one of them, yeah, that's for sure.
Now you're in Nashville?
We are, yes.
How's that going for you?
Yeah, it's going good. It's actually, we're getting used to it. It's a really good place. There's some great people and, you know, some of our very favorite artists are there and musicians that we run into all the time now, and they know us by name. So that's good.
Who are some of your favorites?
Well, people like Buddy Miller and Tim O'Brien and Gillian Welsh and David Rawlings and, you know, Sam Bush and Baylor Fleck and those sorts. Just those
all
folks.
All the greats.
Well, Carol, I read on your website, you were talking about, you went to a Gillian Welsh and David Rawlings show recently.
Yeah, I spoke to Gillian and Dave a few weeks ago, and I said, what is this Dave Rawlings machine gig? And he said, well, it's like Gillian and Dave together, the same thing, except it's their unannounced shows, where they don't advertise them.
They just show up.
And you just keep checking on Dave Rawlings' MySpace. Mm-hmm. So I kept checking, nothing there, had a night off, and I thought, I'll just check to see what the Basement's got playing in Nashville, and it had the Dave Rawlings, DRM, you know, they call it.
Yeah.
And they came on at midnight, really rainy night in Nashville, still like packed it out. And then halfway through the set, they got Norah Jones up to sing, which was unbelievable. They did a Townes Van Zandt song, you know, Loretta.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. One of the great moments, you know.
Yeah.
You expect it, you hear about those moments in Nashville.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was one of them.
That was one of them.
And then you headed home and had a Vegemite sandwich. Is that what you said?
Vegemite on toast.
What is Vegemite? I have no idea.
It's a yeast spread.
It's just black, thick spread that you put on stuff. Australians eat it. It is yeast. It's yeast extract. That's all it is. It's like salt, thick salt, if you can imagine. It's really good.
It's
we
black.
Like it.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it sounds delicious.
Black, thick and salty. Wonderful.
But it's part of the staple diet in Australia. You know, the kids, the first thing they have besides, you know, milk formula or, you know, milk would be a piece of bread without any butter on it, the crust cut off it, and just Vegemite on it. And they just sit there and chew on Vegemite on bread.
And you don't get over it. You do that for the rest of your life, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, peanut butter and jelly, I guess, is the American solution or answer to that. We don't do that. We go for the salt.
Right. Like comfort food is kind of what that's about. Yeah, exactly. Well, we would love to hear a song from you all.
This is the
first tune you're going to do, something off the new album,
Viridian? Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right, this is a song, and there's a guy called David Mead. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but we certainly are, and we love him. And I wrote this song with him. I just really wanted to try and write with him, and a few friends hooked us up, and we wrote this one here. This is River of Sand.
Excellent.
Thank you.
where it sang. Every time I believe what I heard about mirages that fade like the words of a song. Now I know I was wrong.
New album is called Viridian, River of Sand, which is co-written with David Meath. And beautiful song. Nice job, Carol, on vocals on that. That's just beautiful. This new record was produced by Doug Lancio, and I believe he worked with Patty Griffin at one time. So is he an Austin guy? Or
he's actually East Nashville.
East Nashville,
guy.
Okay.
He's actually within walking distance from my house, actually, where
really?
He lives. But he's back there in East Nashville. There's an awful lot of... really cool sort of under the radar musicians and producers who live in East Nashville, and they kind of have a whole different scene going on that you wouldn't normally associate with Nashville,
right.
You know, and I think Doug kind of falls into that category.
How did you all decide on having him produce this record, and what was it about him or his style that attracted you to having him?
He might have been the one person that we all agreed upon. I think that might have been a factor.
Yeah.
We're all big fans of Doug. He's done some great work with Patty Griffin and a mm-hmm. bunch of other people, and we really admired his work.
Mm-hmm. And I was curious how this record's been different for you guys from the past. I mean, you know, you went from a place of... You've only been together 5 years, which really, in band terms, is not, you know, like terribly long, although you've had a lot of success in a fairly short amount of time. So I'm curious as to how this record's been different for you. If you, I mean, can you tell that, you know, you guys have grown a lot as a band? And
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, we've evolved from the first record to this one as far as, you know, stylistically or writing, and I think we're a lot more comfortable making this record. We just, we didn't overanalyze it too much this time. We certainly put in a lot of work writing and finding songs, but once we decided to get into the studio and record it, we wanted to just sort of play the songs live and just let them go where they were going to naturally go, and that was one thing that Doug brought out a lot with the, you know, co-producing the record with us, was that he didn't want to overanalyze things too much. Let's just play the songs, and if things, you know, get somewhere, then that's probably where they need to get to. So, you know, that was certainly the case. And we've had some, you know, I mean, this is, some people have played this record that haven't played our other records in the past, and and there's probably some stations that have played us and won't play this one, but that's just the way it goes. And we just, you know, we really weren't too concerned about a stylistic thing as far as needing to sound like anyone. We're pretty comfortable with who we sound like now, and we just went in to make the record we wanted to make, and we're lucky that our label let us do it.
Yeah.
And whether they're happy about that now or not, we're not sure, but no, we're proud of it.
Right. Well, you should be. I think it's a great new record. There's several songs on here I wish we had time to talk about, but one of them was All the Way from Italy, which is just a gorgeous tune. Did you write that, Carol, or who wrote that one?
I wrote that.
You wrote that
as well. I wrote that with Jed Hughes, another young Aussie friend of mine. And just cutting long story short, that's just the basic story of my family coming from Italy to Australia back around the Second World War.
Okay.
And I've wanted to write it for a long time, but I just never really got around to it, or had never felt comfortable writing that song until Jed and I got together one day and a couple of bottles of Aussie red wine, and we banged it out.
We got time for one more tune if you all were up for it.
Which one? It's Lonesome.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. All right, we're going to do this one here. This is more of a grassy thing. It's the Lonesome Side of Town.
Excellent.
One, two. As I put in the driveway last evening, all my things are scattered on the ground. Steps clearing and the air right up the ocean. I was headed for the bones inside of town.
Home, I need a snug feeling. We all share a little common ground. As a woman's right to blame, our story's all the same. They're living on the lonesome side of town.
Time I got to work on Monday, word from top has come down. They're locking all the doors tomorrow morning. We'll see you on the bones inside of town.
Oh, my name is not feeling. We all share a little common ground. There's a woman's right to blame. Our story's all the same. We're living on the lonesome side. Share a little common ground. There's a woman's right
that was fantastic. Lonesome Side of Town. These guys are so good. The Green Cards. Yeah, you're right. It's pretty grassy, pretty bluegrassy there. It sounded great. And you wrote that, Kim?
Yes, I did. That's I wrote it with a guy called Jerry Sally.
Yeah. You sound like you grew up in Kentucky on that song.
Well, my dad thought he grew up in Kentucky, so that's what it was, I think.
The new album is called Viridian, and it's a great one. And thank you all so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Great to see you all again.
More information on the Green Cards and their new video can be found at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Robin Fisher learns about accidental medical breakthroughs. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. We're all familiar with that image of the scientist in the white coat toiling away in a lab looking for a cure for some disease, and lo and behold, finding it. But as Morton Myers points out in his new book, Happy Accidents, Serendipity, and Modern Medical Breakthroughs, the scientist may have found something completely different than what he or she was looking for. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Myers about keeping an open mind in medical discoveries.
I found the book fascinating and wondered if you could start out actually with a basic definition of serendipity, because I've always heard it used incorrectly.
Well, I think unfortunately that's true. What the term itself means accurately is looking for one thing and yet stumbling over something else that leads you to something of even greater value. It's an unexpected finding that proves to be of greater benefit than when one had set out for. Unfortunately, as the term has gotten picked up in everyday language, its meaning has become subverted. And now it's used quite often to mean simply a pleasant surprise. But it's not being overly a purist to feel that its original meaning ought to be maintained, namely, looking for one thing and stumbling over something of even greater value.
And in the book, you use numerous examples of serendipity in medical research and scientific research. When researchers are looking for one thing and they find another, and you say at one point that accidental discoveries would be nothing without keen creative minds knowing what to do with them.
Yes, I think what that means is that I think it's a very common experience for all of us to find something that we didn't expect. And maybe you look in your attic for your old ski boots and you come across a cameo that you feel is precious from your grandmother. And on the commercial side, the same kind of thing has happened quite commonly. For instance, many of the things that we use in our everyday culture happen entirely through chance. Among those, I can just mention briefly Post-it notes, which is well known. Nylon was discovered accidentally. All the artificial sweeteners, of course, were accidental discoveries. It's understandable if one thinks about it in the sense that you can't really expect a bench lab researcher to go tasting things consciously. So it's only by accidental spillage or some powder left on fingers that ends up in the researcher's mouth until he realizes that it's incredibly sweet, for instance. And what the sentence that you're citing means, therefore, is we all stumble, but it takes a particular mind to be open to the inadvertent finding that stumbling leads to. It takes a mind that's curious, that's directed toward the unknown, that is able to pursue what other people might consider a distraction or a happenstance. And in medicine, a surprising number of major discoveries occurred exactly through that. Some people may recognize an old axiom that dates back to Pasteur in the late 19th century. It's become rather famous, that chance favors the prepared mind. And what that implies, of course, is that we all come across unexpected things, but unless we're either trained or have the cognitive skill to recognize that something is unexpected and might be gainful and pursue that, often it takes perseverance and combating conventional wisdom, for instance, but it does take a keen mind to exploit that finding. A paradigm for that is Charles Darwin, who was famous for pursuing what seemed to be exceptions to various principles or happenstance. And from this genius with the mind of Charles Darwin developed the theory of evolution, for instance. But in medicine and in science in general, an astonishing number of advances that we now incorporate into our everyday lives that have lengthened our lives, that have improved our lifestyle, were simply stumbled upon and were pursued by a mind that was open to the possibilities of that.
Well, one of the early examples that you use in the book is about Dramamine, the drug for motion sickness. And I found that interesting. Number one, I didn't know that Dramamine was an antihistamine.
Yeah.
And just... I guess if I had been the scientist, I would have written the motion sickness off as an unwanted side effect or a wanted side effect. But I find it fascinating that they were able to think outside the box and then do further testing to say, hey, this might not do what we wanted it to do, but it's great for motion sickness.
Exactly. That's very true, of course. Dramamine was discovered maybe 50 years ago. Quite inadvertently by two physicians at a university hospital who were treating a patient for allergies and gave her this newly developed antihistamine. And then the patient reported that her long-standing car sickness seemed to be considerably alleviated. Now, many other people, of course, would simply neglect the opportunity that reporting by the patient yielded, but these two physicians were keen enough to exploit it, applied it to other patients with motion sickness, and then became involved with a federal project that was ultimately called Operation Seasickness, with a large ship carrying sailors across the turbulent North Sea and who were given Dramamine. And the results in terms of combating motion sickness were very impressive. And to such a degree that it's now such a common commercial project that even today can be found in the drugstore and be bought over the counter.
So another really interesting thing, you gave several examples in the book of experiments where something other than what was going on in the experiment affected the outcome. A cleaning agent... a change in a cleaning agent. I know there was one case where it was the change in the Dreft, ingredients in Dreft.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And, you know, to me that even goes beyond sort of the Dramamine example because that was still along the same lines. You give it to the patient, it doesn't have the desired effect you wanted, but it does control the motion sickness. These examples were almost things that sort of ruined the experiments.
Well, you're absolutely right. The example you're pointing to occurred to a biochemist at the University of Rochester in the 1940s who was working as part of the Manhattan Project. And everything in his research was going very fine, day after day after day. They got very successful results, and he was very pleased. And then all of a sudden, the experiments came to a halt in terms of yielding positive results. They were very stymied. But one day he reports that he walked into the lab and he happened to notice sitting on the corner of a laboratory bench a detergent box on which was emblazoned a bright star claiming that this is the new Dreft, the name of the detergent at the time, and what was new is that it contained a new water softener. And he came to realize that what was blocking his experiments was exactly that, namely the new water softener, which was a chemical that adhered the elements that he was dealing with in his experiment to the sides of the glass flasks and test tubes he was working on. But he didn't stop just then and pursued the other attributes of that inadvertently discovered chemical and came to realize that it yielded the key to him to understand the metabolism across the cell of the wall. At that time, the cell wall... which is a fantastically important structure to understand in terms of science, was just an ambiguous concept, an abstract notion. This was before the era of electron microscopy. But in pursuing the attributes of that chemical, he came to realize it was the key that unlocked the transport mechanisms across the cell wall. And on the basis of that, he was the first to define that it was truly metabolically active structure. An amazing story, exactly reflecting what you're citing of something that flummoxed an experiment and yet was keenly turned around to produce a great result.
Now, you make some interesting observations about art when you're talking about keeping an open mind, and I wondered if you could share that with our listeners.
Yes, of course. Let me just start by saying I think science, to many people, is not considered creative. If you use the word creativity, I think most people would think of art in that sense. But science is very creative, and art, science, and indeed in certain ways religion, all share the same idea of trying to present a picture to define the reality of the world. The whole goal of art, for example, is to allow the artist to be self-expressive, to reflect his sense of reality, to define it in a certain way, and to hope that the viewer or the potential audience or the potential user can see reality in the same way as the artist. That those same terms can be used for a scientist. He is trying to be self-expressive. He is trying to be creative. He is trying to represent reality as it exists behind the... Einstein had a beautiful phrase for this, of lifting the corner of the veil, of revealing the mystery that lies behind the appearance of things. And that's the goal of a scientist. So in my mind, always, there's a great similarity between an artist and a scientist. Some of this feeling in people's minds actually dates back to the 1930s with a classic essay called Two Cultures by C.P. Snow, who felt that the two were so diametrically opposite that they could never be reconciled. In fact, W.H. Auden, the great poet, said that in the presence of scientists and doctors, he felt like a local parish priest in the presence of bishops. I mean, he had an undue respect for scientists and physicians, but they are basically the same motivations, the same impulses, and share a lot of the same personal characteristics.
But now you feel that that this creativity is sort of being pushed out of the scientific culture.
Regrettably, to a significant degree. Much of science education, and I can certainly speak especially for medical school education, stresses the acquisition of facts and doesn't deal with the process through which those facts were obtained. So medical school education and general science education lacks the teaching of how to think, of how to pursue either a thought or to contradict a currently held dogma, but it emphasized instead simply the acquisition of knowledge without learning the best ways to apply that knowledge or to be sensitive to exceptions to what is held to be the current knowledge. And in the last chapter, I do recommend certain ways, hopefully, to improve that situation, to place an emphasis to a much greater degree on cognitive skills. The basis of any... let me define discovery. Discovery can't be planned, almost by definition. Discovery has to be a serendipitous occurrence. If you know something is there and you come to it, that is not a discovery. That is, falls more into the realm of invention. I'd like to say that we invent by intention. We have an intention to build something, and we can build it from the known constructs, but we discover by surprise. So inherent in the idea of discovery is the idea that it's a surprise, that it's something unexpected, which is to say that it requires serendipity, which is to say that it's a creative act to be aware of it and to pursue it to uncover the truth. And this has to be taught to a much greater degree in order to further advance us. If one looks back on the major breakthroughs in drugs, for instance, in this country, much of the major life-saving drugs happened up until perhaps the 1980s. And unfortunately, in the last 25 years, there's been much more emphasis on copycat drugs, Me Too drugs, on lifestyle drugs, rather than a real breakthrough to uncover further life-saving drugs. So the idea of teaching students that of the value of inconsistencies, of anomalies, of comparisons, of finding similarities among differences, of finding differences among similarities, of the value of analogy and of metaphor, constructs that are usually thought of more in terms of literature, certainly, than in science. But all of these things are essential in order to foster a greater sense of creativity and particularly of the value of serendipity.
Can you tell us what is a eureka moment and give us an example from the book?
I'm sorry?
A eureka moment?
Yes. To visualize the arteries that feed the heart, the coronary arteries, was held off for decades because it was thought that there would be too much risk of putting a dye into the coronary arteries. But in the 1950s, at the Cleveland Clinic, for instance, a cardiologist by the name of Mason Soans was doing what a routine procedure at the time of introducing a catheter through a leg vein and passing it up into the heart and putting in a dye that one could see on the x-ray in order to see the chambers of the heart. But what happened was a situation that horrified him as he was watching, because the tip of the catheter flipped like a garden hose could, and instead of entering the heart chamber, entered the opening of a coronary artery, and this undue amount of dye was injected into the coronary artery. Soans thought that that would damage the heart muscle and the patient would go into an abnormal rhythm and die. So he rushed to the side of the patient with a scalpel in hand, thinking that perhaps he would have to open the chest in order to manually compress the heart and allow it to maintain its rhythm. But the patient did lose pulse for a few seconds. He remained conscious. Soans asked him to cough. The patient did cough, and his heart rhythm returned. For Soans, besides being greatly relieved that the patient didn't have any dire effects, this was a huge eureka moment, because he realized then that one could put dye into the coronary artery. And since that was possible, one could therefore visualize the coronary arteries by x-ray. He developed the technique over the next 2 years. He did it on a multiplicity of patients. He reported it in a simple four-page report in a cardiology journal, and it swept the world. But it was his eureka moment that led to what is now so standard, the number of heart bypasses that are done in this country, and the insertion of stents into points of blockages of the coronary arteries. There's now something like a million stents. Americans have stents put in every year now in this country. And all of that happened through the eureka moment that Mason Soans could see clearly through this accident.
Well, Dr. Myers, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Morton Myers about his new book, Happy Accidents, Serendipity and Modern Medical Breakthroughs. The book is published by Arcade Press and is available at bookstores in the Louisville area. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.